From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
You know, the president goes around the country speaking Spanish. The only Spanish he speaks when it comes to jobs is hasta la vista.
The first official Democratic debate and first ever bilingual presidential debate in history. We'll play excerpts. Is the Bush administration poised to end overtime? We'll have a debate between the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the AFL-CIO. And the World Trade Organization and thousands of protesters head to Cancun. We'll speak with Joseph Stiglitz, the 2001 Nobel Prize winner in economics, former official of the World Bank, on globalization and its discontents. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Washington suffered a double blow in its plans for Iraq yesterday as France and Germany balked at the Bush administration's proposals for an international force, while British Prime Minister Tony Blair gave a cautious response to a call for 5,000 extra British troops. The draft resolution sponsored by the United States attempts to create a UN mandate for an international force while keeping the troops under U.S. command. Washington is urgently seeking ways to reduce the burden on its 140,000 troops in Iraq because of increasing casualties and the cost of occupation. But skepticism is running high in the corridors of the UN, where diplomats have not forgotten the diplomatic bloodletting of last winter that resulted in the U.S. and Britain invading and occupying Iraq without UN authorization. The French and others are determined to make it clear the UN in no way legitimizing the U.S. decision to go to war against Iraq. France holds veto power over the resolution. Many states also want the UN and the political process to be put on a much firmer basis. The U.S. is anxious to get that approval before the General Assembly meets later this month. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld toured Iraq yesterday, where he said Washington will speed up training for Iraqi security forces, including former members of Saddam Hussein's military and intelligence services. He said the U.S. military is, quote, looking at ways of accelerating the process of bringing former members of Saddam's military and possibly his security services into the Iraqi security forces. Meanwhile, Rumsfeld may be the only person in Iraq who does not have complaints about the country's massive shortages of electricity. After returning on a Black Hawk helicopter from one downtown compound to an American base near the city's airport, Rumsfeld said, quote, "For a city that's not supposed to have power, there's lights all over the place. It's like Chicago." According to a report in the Arab language Al Hayat newspaper, a delegation from the Israeli intelligence service, the Mossad, visited Baghdad last month in order to coordinate its anti-terrorism efforts with the U.S. forces in Iraq. Basing its report on comments made by an anonymous Kurdish official, the newspaper claimed the delegation carried out a field tour in the Iraqi capital and aerial tours in the U.S. military helicopter above Mosul, Tikrit, and Ramadi. The official claimed U.S.-Israeli security coordination in Iraq has been stepped up. While there have been reports that Israeli companies have been invited by the U.S. to do business in Iraq, this is the first report of Israeli security officials visiting the country. Iran's spiritual leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei mentioned last week that an Israeli delegation visited Baghdad without identifying the nature of its mission. A civilian affiliated with oil field services giant Halliburton was shot and killed in Iraq, the second person connected to the firm to die in an attack in a month. The employee, who was not identified, worked for Halliburton subsidiary Kellogg Brown and Root and was assigned to a team supporting Army mail delivery. The U.S. military in Baghdad confirmed a U.S. civilian contractor was killed Wednesday in Iraq, but would not offer any details. An American civilian contractor employed by KBR was killed August 5th when a remote-controlled bomb exploded under the truck he was driving north of Saddam Hussein's hometown of Tikrit. Halliburton, the oil field services and construction company formerly led by Vice President Dick Cheney, has major contracts for reconstruction in both Iraq and Afghanistan. Iraq's new foreign minister said on Thursday Turkish troops should not be led into Iraq as peacekeepers, as their presence could undermine the security of the country rather than improve it. Turkey's prime minister brushed off the foreign minister's objections to a Turkish presence in Iraq, saying that his country, which is in talks with U.S. and military officials on a possible deployment, would decide for itself. The father of a soldier killed in an accident in Iraq, former prisoner of war, says that former president The father of a soldier killed in an incident in Iraq said former prisoner of war Jessica Lynch survived that Lynch's military million-dollar book deal will taint the memory of the soldiers killed in an ambush. Randy Keel, the father of Army Specialist James Keel, said, quote, pretty severe, isn't it, that she makes money off the death of my son and off the deaths of so many others. On Tuesday, a publisher announced Lynch signed a $1 million deal for a book that will tell Lynch's story. Keel called Lynch a profiteer and said he also blames the publisher and others who waved that million-dollar check in front of her. The Pentagon is spending millions of dollars to develop environmentally friendly lead-free bullets for all of the U.S. armed forces. They will still kill you, the thinking seems to be, but the environment will not suffer as much. The Pentagon's paying Minnesota-based Alliant, the world's largest ammunition maker, $5 million to develop lead-free combat bullets. A former Howard University professor and Palestinian activist is scheduled to be jailed for the second time in 5 years for refusing to testify before a grand jury investigating the Palestinian group Hamas's finances and activities. Abdelhalim Ashkar, who taught at Howard for 3 years, gained national attention for a six-month hunger strike in 1998 when he was jailed for not cooperating with a New York grand jury. In a separate case last month in Chicago, a court again held Ashkar in civil contempt for refusing to talk to a grand jury even after he was granted immunity. Unless he wins an appeal, Ashkar said he'll fly to Chicago on Friday to go to jail rather than participate in what he called a witch hunt against Palestinians fighting Israeli oppression. Authorities allege Ashkar organized meetings with activists from the Islamic Resistance Movement in Philadelphia in 1993 and Oxford, Mississippi, where he was a graduate student in 1994. He's never been indicted or charged with a crime. Miguel Estrada, the Honduran-born lawyer selected by President Bush to be a judge on the powerful U.S. appellate court, gave up his two-year quest to win Senate confirmation in the face of unshakable Democratic opposition to a nomination laden with partisan, ethnic, and constitutional overtones. Bush reluctantly withdrew the nomination of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit after Estrada told him he wanted to move on with his legal career and family life. In an angry statement released by the White House, the president said Estrada had received disgraceful treatment from Democrats who blocked a confirmation vote. He called it an unfortunate chapter in the Senate's history. Democrats portrayed the Washington lawyer as an extreme conservative, unwilling to answer basic questions about his judicial philosophy, quietly claiming a significant victory.
Here to build the big guns. Here to build the death planes. Here to build all the bombs. Here to hide behind walls. Here to hide behind discs. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes. And you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won.
Bob Dylan, Masters of War, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers.
Well, Juan, the first official Democratic presidential debate was also the first ever bilingual presidential debate in history in this country.
Last night in New Mexico, and appropriately in New Mexico, the state with the largest Latino population in the country, about 45% of New Mexico. It will soon become the first majority Latino state in the country over the next 10 years. And, of course, in a state whose governor now, Bill Richardson, has ambitions of trying to become a vice presidential nominee of some Democratic candidate. So it's appropriate that it be held there.
And it also, of course, underscores the significance of the largest minority in this country and its voting power.
Yeah, well, I think the clearly a lot of attention since the 2000 census has focused on the growth of the Latino community in the country, just about surpassing now the African-American population. But the key issue for the politicians is that the Latino growth is in key states. 30% of California is Hispanic now, 30% of Texas, about 20% of Florida. And, of course, it's also growing in a bunch of western states that have always been considered Republican strongholds, Colorado, 20% Latino, Nevada, Utah, all of these states that now the Republicans have to worry about. And the additional thing is that unlike African-Americans who have been pretty consistent now over the last 30 years voting overwhelmingly Democratic, the Latinos in the Latino vote in presidential elections has tended to have a swing situation from about a high of about 40% in during the period of Ronald Reagan. Reagan was able to get about 40% of Latino vote, to a low of about 10% when Dole ran against Clinton. So that that's a huge shift when you consider the margins of the popular vote in the last few presidential elections. So that the Republicans and the Democrats understand that that huge possibility of shift among Latino voters between Democrats and Republicans is going to be critical in this presidential election, given the growth of the overall Latino vote. Mm-hmm.
Well, we're going to go to an excerpt of that vote. We'll actually start of the debate.
Oh, and I have to add, Amy, that both moderators are not only good friends of mine, but members of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists. Ray Suarez of the Laird NewsHour and Marilena Salinas, the veteran anchor of Univision News.
And they, as you said, they emceed this debate, and it was translated simultaneously into Spanish, and some of the candidates even attempted Spanish. But we're going to start at the top, play an excerpt, and this the first questions were about war. It begins with the former Vermont governor, Howard Dean.
Well, as you know, I believed from the beginning that we should not go into Iraq without the United Nations as our partner. And in this situation, fortunately, the president is finally beginning to see the light. We cannot do this by ourselves. We cannot have an American occupation and reconstruction. We have to have a reconstruction of Iraq with the United Nations, with NATO, and preferably with Muslim troops, particularly Arabic-speaking troops from our allies such as Egypt and Morocco. We cannot have American troops serving under United Nations command. We've never done that before. But we can have American troops serving under American command. And it's very clear to me that in order to get the United Nations and NATO into Iraq, this president is going to have to go back to the very people he humiliated, our allies, on the way into Iraq, and hope that they will now agree with us that we were wrong to go, that they will now agree with us that we need their help there. We were wrong to go in without the United Nations. Now we need their help, and that's not a surprise.
Congressman Gephardt, you were one of the early supporters of the Iraq intervention and voted to authorize the use of power there. Touch on those same points. How much authority, how much decision-making power can the United States cede in order to get the cooperation of its allies for the mission from here on out?
I told President Bush a year and a half ago that if he wanted to deal with Iraq and weapons, he needed to go to the UN, he needed to get their help, he needed to get NATO's help. He was not able to do it. He should have done it after we went in. I even told him in an early stage, you're not going to need him going in, you're going to need him coming out. I said, this is going to be complicated, difficult, and long. He needs to be there now. Let me tell you something. We have a president who has broken up the alliances that Democratic and Republican presidents have put together over 70 years. We need our friends. We need friends from all over the world in Iraq now. We can't afford $1 billion a week. We can't be losing all the people that are lost over there. It would be a big difference in Iraq if we had an international force there and not just American and British troops. He is not doing this job. When I am president, I will go back to the UN, I will go to NATO, I will repair these alliances, and we will again lead a world alliance against terrorism and the other problems that we face.
Congressman Kucinich, some of those allies that the two earlier speakers have referred to have already said that the current resolution that's circulating doesn't go far enough. Can we keep American civil administration and American military administration as it currently exists and expect the rest of the world to come to the aid of the United States?
I believe that it is time to bring the troops home. It is time to bring the UN in and get the U.S. out. Ahora es el tiempo de volver nuestros soldados de Iraq. And what we need to do in order to accomplish that is to get the United Nations together on an agreement that provides for the following. First, that the UN will handle the collection and distribution of all oil revenues for the people of Iraq without privatization. Second, that the UN will handle all contracts, no more Halliburton sweetheart deals. And third, that the United Nations will proceed to work with the people of Iraq to construct a government that the people of Iraq can call their own. Under those conditions, the United States can move away from Bush's blunder, which Iraq will be known as, because there was no reason to go into Iraq at war with Iraq in the first place, and everyone who took the responsibility on this stage has to answer to the American people for voting for that war. I led the effort against it.
Maria Elena.
Right, let's go to Senator Kerry, who voted for and was a very strong supporter of going to war with Iraq. Now, what does going back to the UN after we basically told the UN or the U.S. basically told the United Nations that it was irrelevant, what does that do to our standing in the world?
It will raise our standing in the world to behave as we ought to, according to the highest values and traditions of our country, which is to work with other nations. What we know now is that being flown to an aircraft carrier and pronouncing the words mission accomplished does not end a war. And the swagger of a president who says bring them on does not bring our troops peace or safety. And I intend, I will return. I believe we need a president who understands how to get it right in the beginning. This is the third opportunity of the president to try to get it right. The first was when we originally gave the authority of force, when he told us and Colin Powell told us they would go to the UN and build a coalition. The president didn't do it. He failed in his diplomacy. He rushed to war against our warnings, and he has now inherited the win, so to speak. Secondly, he had another opportunity. When that statue of Saddam Hussein was toppled, that was the moment for a president of courage and leadership to say to the world, now we've done what we had to do, but we want the world to come to the effort and join us. This is the third opportunity, and it is critical that this president gives life to the notion that the United States of America never goes to war because we want to. We should only go to war because we have to, and we must hold the United Nations up for what it is. If you didn't have it, you'd have to invent it. And this president needs to understand that.
Let's go on to Senator Lieberman. Senator Lieberman, you said in the past that there is not an inch of difference between President Bush and yourself in the war against Iraq, but you have asked recently for more troops and more resources for Iraq, a very different point of view from the president's. Are you still that close to the president, Lynch?
That statement was made, Maria Elena, as we were about to go to war. And what I said, I believe, expressed the best traditions and values of the United States, which is when American men and women in uniform go into battle, there's not an inch of space between any of us on that question. Look, long before George Bush became president, I reached a conclusion that Saddam Hussein was a threat to the United States of America and to the world, and particularly to his own people, who he was brutally suppressing. I believe that the war against Saddam was right and that the world is safer with him gone. I said last fall, and then again in February, a month before the war, Mr. President, here's what you have to do to get ready to secure post-Saddam Iraq. No planning was done by this administration. I believe it's because this is an administration divided within itself, and the president as commander-in-chief has not brought it together. As president, I would have listened to the American military when they said we need more troops to secure Iraq. I would have gotten off of pride and hurt feelings and gone to the NATO and the United Nations and asked them to join us in securing and rebuilding this country. I would have brought the Iraqis into control of the country. Let me say this to the question asked earlier. I didn't support the war against Saddam Hussein so we could control Iraq. Quite the contrary. I supported it so we could get rid of Saddam and let the Iraqis control Iraq. So I would negotiate whatever resolution at the United Nations will draw our allies with us into keeping the peace, rebuilding the country, and holding hope that the American soldiers can soon return to their families in peace.
And that was Senator Joseph Lieberman, part of the Democratic presidential debate, the first ever bilingual presidential debate held in U.S. history. The others who participated were Senator John Edwards of North Carolina, former Illinois Senator Carol Moseley Braun, and Al Sharpton was supposed to be there, the Reverend Al Sharpton, but didn't show up. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to talk about the WTO ministerial, the meeting that will be taking place next week in Cancun. The Democratic presidential candidates also talked about trade. We're then going to have a debate on whether Bush will be doing away with overtime pay in this country between the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the AFL-CIO. Stay with us. Angelique Cajot here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Let's go back to the Democratic presidential debate for a moment in New Mexico and hear what Senator John Kerry and Congressmember Dennis Kucinich had to say about the issue of the World Trade Organization and trade. It begins with Congressmember Dennis Kucinich.
Really needs to be looked at, and that is NAFTA makes it impossible
to be able to protect workers' rights. Now, those people who say they're going to put conditions on NAFTA, if you put conditions on NAFTA, that's WTO illegal. So what we need to do, the only way that we can go back to trade which will work for the American people and for people all over North America, is to make sure that we have workers' rights, human rights, and environmental quality principles in trades. And by workers' right, I mean this: the right to collective bargaining, the right to strike, the right to join a union, the right to decent wages and benefits, the right to a safe workplace, the right to a secure retirement. Those have to be written specifically into our trade agreements, and they were not. We had intellectual property written into the trade agreements, and we need specifically written into the trade agreements prohibitions on child labor, slave labor, prison labor. But you know what? Unless we cancel NAFTA and withdraw from the WTO, we aren't going to get there. So all of this is just talk. I'm the one, first day in office, cancel NAFTA, cancel the WTO, return to bilateral trade with all those conditions we've just spoken about. Thank you.
Well, let me get your response on this, Senator Kerry, because I know that you've been a big supporter of free trade over the past years. Earlier today, I went to the University of New Mexico bookstore, as I'm bound to do, and I bought T-shirts for all my children. None of them were made in the United States, though they were all made in this hemisphere.
Correct.
Very clearly labeled in the collar. Is the answer making those things here, or just making sure they're made there in a better way?
No, I think Dennis, I admire what he is saying, and I am as strongly committed as he is to those worker rights and to the efforts to raise the level. But it would be disastrous to just cancel it. You have to fix it. You have to have a president who understands how to use the power that we have as the world's biggest marketplace to properly leverage the kind of behavior that we want. You also have to have a president who's prepared to have an enforcement structure, particularly an attorney general whose name is not John Ashcroft, who is prepared to enforce the laws, and the president himself, through the powers of the various sections of the trade agreement, has the ability to get tougher.
That was Senator John Kerry. And they're debating in New Mexico last night in Albuquerque at Pope Joy Hall, University of New Mexico, the Democratic presidential candidates. As we go now to the issue of trade and the World Trade Organization, the meeting about to take place next week at the Mexican resort of Cancun. The Guardian of London's reporting Mexican security officials have developed a watch list containing the names of 80 activists and academics who are believed to attend the World Trade Organization protests, to protest the creation of the list. A growing number of activists are voluntarily submitting their own names to the so-called watch list, saying that they are disturbed that the Mexican officials were only able to find 60 internationals and 20 Mexicans who are opposed to the World Trade Organization. We're joined on the telephone right now by Joseph Stiglitz, who is the was a former chief economist of the World Bank, a winner of the 2001 Nobel Prize in Economics, now a professor at Columbia University, and author of the book Globalization and Its Discontents. We're also joined on the telephone by Lori Wallach, director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Before we go to Professor Stiglitz, I wanted to ask Lori Wallach, you're one of the people on that list. Will you be able to get into Cancun?
I'm certainly planning on going.
And what have the Mexican officials told you about this watch list?
They haven't told us anything. The watch list leaked, and so it was reported in the Mexican press. And the list is very interesting in that the majority of the people on the list, the only thing they're known to throw around are ideas. So it seems the Mexican government is most afraid of challenging ideas of the status quo of the WTO and its version of globalization.
Joseph Stiglitz, welcome to Democracy Now! Wanted to ask you first about Congressmember Kucinich's comment, get rid of the World Trade Organization and NAFTA. Do you agree?
No, I think Senator Kerry was precisely correct. There are lots of things wrong with NAFTA and WTO, but the answer is to fix it, not leave it. An imperfect rule of law is still better than no rule of law. And having, if we didn't have the WTO, it would things would be far worse.
Well, Professor Stiglitz, your book, Globalization and Its Discontents, for someone who has been involved in as a chief economist for the World Bank, was pretty critical of policies of some of these international bodies in terms of how they're pursuing trade policy and economic policy around the world. Could you summarize?
Everybody agrees intellectual property is important, but you need a balanced agreement. It was driven by our pharmaceuticals and our entertainment industry, by these commercial interests rather than for the broader either global interest, and I would say even for American interest.
But in terms of the broader policy issue of the continued drive to lower tariffs and open up markets that really benefit the more advanced industrial countries, clearly in places like Latin America, you're having a major rebellion by the peoples in all of these countries now who are electing much more radical people who are questioning and criticizing deeply the policies, especially of the IMF and the United States.
That's right. And the reason in the area of trade, which is at the focus right now, the reason is they see these as unfair trade agreements that the United States has insisted that they take away their tariffs, eliminate their subsidies, but the United States has kept its trade barriers, it's kept its subsidies to the goods they care about, which is agriculture. It was just on Brazil, and the adverse effects of our subsidies there and all around the world is enormous. So the concern is that it's an unfair trade arrangement. To give you another example, while we've been taking down tariffs, we've been maintaining huge non-tariff barriers, a whole variety of things, for instance, like they're called dumping duties and countervailing duties. If the Brazilian government, for instance, wants to make available money for investment at what is a perfectly reasonable interest rate, 10 or 15%, they're charged as an unfair subsidy because the IMF has pushed them to have interest rates of 25 or 30%. No business can survive at those interest rates, and the government is just trying to make sure that there's an ability of these countries to produce something. And so that kind of trade regime, particularly when accompanied by these austere fiscal and monetary policies that the IMF often insists on, is a recipe for disaster for the economies, and no wonder the people see that and are unhappy.
Joseph Stiglitz, trade ministers from around the world will be meeting in Cancun, as will thousands of protesters. What do you feel is the checklist to assess the outcome of these talks, or would you like to see them close down?
No, I would obviously like them to go forward, to be successful. But I do think no agreement is better than a bad agreement. And my worry is that there will be a bad agreement or it will pave the road to a bad agreement. Let me give you a couple examples of what I would think of absolutely essential measure, checklist, as you said, for whether it's a fair agreement. In the area, one of the most critical areas is agriculture. The United States and Europe have to agree to quickly eliminate their subsidies. Second area, non-tariff barriers, dumping and countervailing duties. We treat unfair trade practices in the United States completely different from the way we treat so-called unfair trade practices abroad. They all ought to be brought under, I worry about unfair trade practices, but we have a framework of thinking about them, the antitrust laws, and that ought to be the framework that should be used both for American firms and for foreign firms.
I'd like to ask Lori Wallach if you could respond. This whole position of Senator Kerry and Professor Stiglitz, don't end it, fix it, when it comes to WTO, what's your response?
I'm sad to say I haven't been able to hear a word of what Professor Stiglitz has been saying.
He responded to Congressmember Kucinich's statement about get rid of the WTO and NAFTA by saying he agrees with John Kerry, who says it should be fixed, not ended.
Well, I think what Senator Kerry said either is knowingly misleading or ill-informed, because what Senator Kerry describes as how to fix it, you can't do within the context of what the actual rules are. You can't sort of add on the things that are missing, because the framework of the whole agreement is throughout all 17 agreements that the WTO enforces heading in the wrong direction. I guess it's a game of semantics. For instance, I believe we need global trade rules. We need a system so that the poor countries don't just get trampled by the rich countries. But I guess a different way of saying what Mr. Kucinich said is we need to replace the trade agreement. We need to have a different set of rules, nearly from top to bottom. And one way to do that, frankly, in the context of the WTO, would be to go back to having the WTO deal with trade, because trade can benefit countries and consumers, but to have get rid of all the other baggage that's been caboosed on to the WTO, such as the intellectual property rules, the constraints on domestic development policy, many of which now forbid the current developing countries to use the same policies that the now rich countries use to develop. We need to get rid of all the extra constraints on domestic policy that really comprise a one-size-fits-all agenda, like typical to the whole structural adjustment program that would be put on a country under the IMF. And now all of that stuff, almost like a Trojan horse strategy, was stuffed inside the name of trade and rolled into our countries, a lot of policies we'd never expect. Then instead of it just being trade, it's trade plus all this other stuff. So there's a global campaign that's called the WTO Shrink or Sink campaign that talks about 11 transformational changes to the current global trade rules in order to preserve the trade part and get rid of all this other baggage. And more or less, that is a major part of what the developing countries are calling for at Cancun. Their agenda is called the implementation agenda. It's been almost totally ignored by the powerful countries and by the WTO staff. But that agenda calls for a list of 100 specific changes to the existing rules. It's a review and repair strategy for the existing rules, not the current strategy on the table at Cancun, which is to expand the WTO, to add 4 new agreements, and to keep going in the same direction.
Professor Stiglitz, what about Lori Wallach's perspective that the about all these other things that the WTO is now exercising control or power over that are really not trade issues, and that this is a fundamental problem? I mean, of course, in addition to the lack of transparency, that's always been a critical issue that dissidents or opponents of the WTO have raised.
Yeah, Lori is right about that. We've tried, the United States has tried to expand the WTO to do things that could not get through national legislatures, Congresses. For instance, to give you just one example, if the issue of whether the poorest people in the world should be denied access to life-saving drugs have been put to a vote of the American people, 99% would have rejected what was adopted in the Uruguay round, the last round of trade negotiations. They would have said it's outrageous. Now there's backpedaling, and there's an attempt to do something about it. But even now, the United States has been maintaining an unreasonable position. I mentioned earlier that in the Chile agreement, there was a provision that says that Chile cannot have the restrictions to keep out to stabilize speculative capital flows, which were so devastating in East Asia, and were the basis of Chile did that during the period 1997 when they grew faster than they ever did before. Now the United States wants to extend that to the whole world. Interestingly,
that's basically a protection of speculators provision?
It says that speculators should have free reign around the world.
And that is, by the way, one of the items that's in what is a proposed new investment agreement that Europe and Japan and the U.S. are pushing to be launched at Cancun for the WTO.
We're going to talk about that next week, but I wanted to ask Professor Stiglitz before you go, because I know you have to leave. You were chief economist of the World Bank during the Battle of Seattle, and with this major protest that's planned at Cancun at the meeting of the WTO, can you talk about the effects of these protests on people within the World Bank, as you were?
Well, I think that inside the World Bank, we were very aware of the inequities of the way the trade arrangements have been going. We've been doing research on that. My successor highlighted the point by pointing out, for instance, that the average cow in Europe gets a $2 a day subsidy, which is more than the poverty level that 4 billion people around the world live. How can they compete against that kind of subsidy? So these have been issues that we have been deeply concerned with. Unfortunately, we have not been able to make much progress raising the public visibility of this issue. And although no one likes riots, they were successful in raising the public visibility of this issue. They put it on the table. And now as I go around the world, it's very interesting. You can't find a person that is not in the involved in the special interest that would defend the U.S. policy in this area, that would defend the European policies in this area. It is just naked special interests that are having such a large effect. And so I think that most Americans, most Europeans, do not fully grasp the inequities, the injustices, and it is important for them to have this brought home to them.
Do you plan to be protesting outside?
No, I'm actually going to be meeting some going to Brunei to meet with some Commonwealth finance ministers to talk about some other issues.
Hmm. Well, we want to thank you for being with us. Joseph Stiglitz, winner of the 2001 Nobel Prize in Economics, former chief economist at the World Bank, now a professor of economics at Columbia University, author of Globalization, Its Discontents, and Lori Wallach, who is headed to Cancun, and we'll find out whether she makes it past customs, being on the watch list of the Mexican government as one of those protesters who plans to go down. Interesting, the letter that has been sent to the Mexican government in protest saying, if you are unwilling to add my name to the list, all those who want their names added in solidarity, then I must insist you remove those singled out for special attention. I can assure you we have similar views. We are all opposed to the WTO and, quote, free trade agenda that impoverished the majority of us while enriching a few corporations. So it sounds like you have a lot of friends, Lori. Lori Wallach, director of the Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, a debate on the proposal by the Bush administration to end overtime pay. Stay with us.
We sew the clothes, the ones that you buy. We can't afford them for ourselves. The price is too high. Our families need food. We don't need name brands. We just like a fair share of the money that's made off of our working hands. We need the right to organize. No sweat, no force, no retire. No sweat, clean drinking water. No sweat, clean air to breathe. No buses screaming, no forced pregnancy tests. The right to speak and be heard. We are workers spreading the word. No sweat. There's lint in the air. Our lungs are all
most You are listening to Democracy Now!, Pat Humphries and friends singing No Sweat. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Political pressure is mounting to block a proposed Labor Department change to existing overtime rules. A key Democrat said he believes he's lined up enough votes to win Senate passage of his measure to block proposed changes in federal work rules. The Senate may vote early next week on an amendment by Democratic Senator Tom Harkin to the Labor Health and Human Services Appropriations Bill. Critics say the new bill will adversely affect millions of mostly white-collar office and health care workers. Proponents of the rule say clarifying rules will alleviate confusion on who qualifies for overtime pay and reduce the growing number of overtime lawsuits filed by workers.
The most significant changes would enable employers to reclassify many workers currently eligible for time and a half overtime, such as managers, administrative, or professional employees, making them exempt. A study by the Economic Policy Institute shows that as many as 8 million workers could lose overtime pay. The Labor Department, on the other hand, disputes that study and says only about 650,000 white-collar workers would lose overtime pay, but that about 1.3 million low-income workers, such as assistant store managers, would now become eligible for overtime. The new rules were proposed March 27th by the Bush administration. This summer, the Labor Department was flooded with a deluge of 78,000 pieces of mail and email sent during a 90-day public comment period. The overwhelming majority of responses appear to oppose the changes.
We're joined right now by Michael Eastman, Director of Labor Policy at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and Karen Nussbaum, Assistant to the President of the AFL-CIO. Let's begin with Karen Nussbaum, your concern about the Bush administration proposal.
Well, we see it as an attempt to take away both money and time from millions of workers who need both even more than ever since the Bush administration has come in. There are the Economic Policy Institute estimates that 8 million workers will lose their overtime pay. These are people like LPNs and store managers and supervisors and cooks, social workers. The average worker who does work overtime, that overtime pay accounts for 25% of their income. It's a gigantic pay cut for people who desperately need it. And if we loosen the overtime regulations, it means that millions more will now lose control over the time that they, the little time left that they do have, and are very likely to be scheduled for overtime that will be free to the employer.
Now, Karen, this would not affect people who already have, for instance, union contracts that guarantee overtime, but it would be largely for workers who are in non-unionized situations?
Well, it'll affect non-union workers first, but it will also affect union workers. You know, contracts are renewed generally every 3 years. Many contracts, employers will then say, well, the rules have changed. These regulations that we had within the contract were based on rules that provide time, and now we're going to revisit that so that it will, again, be on the bargaining table, and now unionized workers will have to fight over whether they're going to have to pay more into their health insurance or whether they're going to keep their overtime pay. So it's a problem for every working person in this country.
Michael Eastman, can you explain why you support the regulations?
Absolutely. We are supportive of this regulatory process in general because our members, the employers in this country, are having a significant difficulty in implementing and complying with the existing regulations defining who is an exempt white-collar employee. Regulations were last comprehensively modified in 1949 and describe jobs such as leg man, straw boss, jobs that simply don't exist today. And, you know, trying to classify someone such as a webmaster under regulations written in 1949 is extremely difficult for them.
Well, Mr. Eastman, we have a solution for you. It's called the Harkin Amendment. Senator Harkin has proposed an amendment which will allow the Department of Labor to clarify and to bring more people under overtime regulations, including low-wage workers, but will prohibit the Department of Labor from taking away overtime protection from any other workers. And that seems to me a great way to solve any problem that employers have.
The Harkin Amendment would essentially freeze in place the outdated regulations that exist today, and it would continue the sort of absurd litigation that we're seeing today under the old regulations, where people such as corporate lawyers, vice presidents, HR directors are being found in through court decisions to be entitled to overtime. Highly educated and compensated people, such as those who train NASA's space shuttle ground control personnel, have been found entitled to overtime. We don't think that these are the sorts of people the Fair Labor Standards Act was meant to protect.
But what about journalists? Because I know that among journalists, that's been a big issue now, whether journalists should be qualified for overtime pay.
I think it is. It is a big issue, and it can be very confusing, especially in television journalism, considering the regulations were written 14 years before the first network began airing 30-minute newscasts. And I think, you know, that's a real concern, and it should be clarified. The department's proposal says that it does only intends to codify existing court decisions to that point. We think it should be more clear. And that's an important point, too, that this is not a sellout to business. If it was, we wouldn't have needed to file 80 pages of comments asking for further clarification. But we have faith in the regulatory process.
You know, I'd have to
Karen Nussbaum of the AFL-CIO.
I do have to disagree with you. The Harkin Amendment does not freeze anything in place. It does mean that working people who need their overtime pay, like nurses, like technicians, like the discount store manager who turns on the light and earns, you know, $22,000, will now not be forced to work all those overtime hours at no pay. And it does open the lid for employers scheduling unending hours for many workers. To my mind, this is not an economy that calls for anybody losing pay, and this is not a society that needs more working people with less control over their time.
And what are the prospects for this attempt by Senator Harkin to basically pass legislation that would prevent rules or administrative changes by the Bush administration?
Well, the Harkin Amendment will come up on Tuesday, and so we urge everyone of your listeners to contact your senators and tell them how important you think it is to make sure that we don't take away time and we don't take away pay from working people in America today. We think that there's an excellent chance that we'll be able to stop this robbery of time and money from working people, but they have to hear from their constituents.
And, Karen, in the few minutes that we have, I'd like to ask you about this whole new initiative of the AFL-CIO to begin basically a national organization for people who are not members of unions at their local workplace. Could you explain what the reasoning behind this is and what this new organization will attempt to do?
Sure. Because of problems like stealing overtime pay, massive tax cuts that are taking money from states and putting schools into free fall, millions more Americans every year going without health insurance. There are many people, working people in this country, who want to be effective, who are angry and frustrated and don't have an effective way to speak out. So we've created an organization for them. It's called Working America. It's for people who don't have the benefit of being in a union but want to be more powerful in speaking out about the problems that they face. So we encourage people to come to us at the website. It's www.workingamerica.org, or to contact us at feedback@AFLCIO.org to let us know that you want to be part of this effort.
So would this function sort of like an AARP for the labor movement, a membership organization that would attempt to influence national policy?
I think that's a good comparison. We won't be able to help people in their specific workplace problems. For that, you really need a regular union. But for the issues that face us overall in America, this will be a far more effective voice than I think we've had and gives people a way to speak out. It'll be community-based. We'll be going door-to-door in many communities around the country. But we also encourage anyone who's interested and concerned and wants to be part of this to contact us to join up.
And Michael Eastman of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, your reaction to this new initiative by the AFL-CIO?
I don't really have a reaction. You know, I think certainly associations of all kinds can can be beneficial to those members who choose to join them. So I think no real reaction.
Well, we want to thank you both for being with us. Michael Eastman, Director of Labor Policy at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and Karen Nussbaum, Assistant to the President of the AFL-CIO, the American Federation of Labor and Congress of Industrial Organizations. That does it for our show as we begin a new segment in this year leading up to the presidential election of 2004. We're going to be trying every few days to go back to the same date the year before and see what the president or the Bush administration overall said. We're going to be especially looking at misstatements like those uttered a year ago. It was a year ago this weekend that the U.S. began its push towards war in Iraq. White House Chief of Staff Andrew Card oversaw the public relations push. He told the New York Times at the time, from a marketing point of view, you don't introduce new products in August. And a year ago Sunday, September 7th, President Bush and Prime Minister Tony Blair met at Camp David to discuss Iraq. Blair told reporters Iraq posed a nuclear threat, citing what he called a new International Atomic Energy Agency. It was later revealed there was no new report from the agency. While the weekend of September 6 marked the beginning of the Bush administration's orchestrated effort to convince the country and the world that Iraq must be invaded, top officials had begun talking about the nuclear threat posed by Iraq. On August 7th, Vice President Dick Cheney told the Commonwealth Club of San Francisco if Saddam Hussein was left to his own devices, quote, "It's the judgment of many of us that in the not-too-distant future he'll acquire nuclear weapons." A week later, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice warned the BBC, quote, "This is a regime that we know has twice tried and come closer than we thought at the time to acquiring nuclear weapons." And on August 26th, Cheney warned that Saddam Hussein could, quote, "seek domination of the entire Middle East, take control of a great portion of the world's energy supplies, directly threaten America's friends throughout the region, and subject the United States or any other nation to nuclear blackmail." And we'll continue looking at these quotes through this year. That does it for the show. If you'd like to get a copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. You can go to our website, democracynow.org, and sign up there for our daily digest to let us know, to let you know what we are doing each day and what's coming up in the days to come. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke and Sharif Abdel-Kaddous, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.